Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always, by you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
There you go. That's the tagline.
That's right.
We are going to keep on going this week with our discussion of free market capitalism, how it works in this country, and whether, in fact, it is working for enough people in this economy. And that, you know, it's an open question, truth be told.
It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that
there
we expect
is.
Our dinner.
It has a sting.
But from their regard to their own interest.
Is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed?
What is free market capitalism?
Is it working for enough people?
It's not working for enough people. That's the bad news. The good news is it can.
They're led by an invisible hand.
You know, financial markets are the first rogue AI.
The stock market is not the economy, and the economy is not the stock market.
I think the next step is to address the assumption that people are rational actors.
No society can be flourishing and happy, of which the far greater part of the members are poor and miserable.
Well, there is hope, but it takes effort.
Is there anything that we can do as individuals to bring about a form of capitalism that works for everyone?
How do you make people care? Man, that sting is so frontline. I love it. I want John Buckley also. The beautifully narrated British accent that you hear there is our editor, John Buckley, who I just want to narrate my life.
Which is, by the way, how he actually talks. It's relevant.
I know.
He was not making
He's
that
not
up.
Even... Yeah. Nah, it's not a put on. He just sounds like that when he's talking about his breakfast. All right. Quick recap for those of you just joining us in this episode. We, all year long, have kind of been bumping up against this idea of a better kind of capitalism. What can we do to make this economy work for more people? This has been a theme on Marketplace writ large. It has been kind of the impetus and all of the findings of the Edison poll research that we've been conducting. Mm-hmm. It's a constant conversation. So you have been delivering all these good ideas for what we should call this. Sustainable capitalism keeps coming up over and over. Non-destructive capitalism, multi-valued capitalism, post-monetary capitalism. All three of those ideas came from one guy, George McKee. David Cabot suggested functional capitalism. Eric Whiffen suggested stopgap capitalism, which he describes as let's just do what we can to keep as few people from starving to death as possible in the short term and hope that our new robot overlords are friendly in the long term. So it gets a little dark and y'all are thinking lots of different directions.
Here's why we are talking about this now, though. We are in the middle of a conversation in this country about our tax code, right? Washington is figuring out how we reallocate capital in this economy. And there is a whole lot of debate over who's going to benefit, who's not going to benefit, who's going to pay, where the money is going to go. Are companies going to get the break? Or are people going to get the break? Is there going to be trickle down? Is there not? All of that stuff. So we decided that this would be a good thing for us to take on. And we have talked to a bunch of people. Phil Kotler from Northwestern University, Arthur Brooks from AEI. Each of them with different points of view on all of this stuff. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to play a little bit of Philip Kotler from Northwestern first and then Arthur Brooks from AEI just to sort of refresh everybody's memories. Here we go.
The working class today in America is barely earning what they earned in the 1980s. That's not because of productivity, because productivity had been rising, but the gains of productivity flowed mainly to the rich who have the capital.
A big part of the reason that we see people at the bottom as such a dead weight on society is because we haven't figured out how to deal with what effectively are distressed human assets.
That was a tough phrase, he said, Arthur Brooks there, with distressed human
tough.
Assets. That was tough.
AEI, by the way, I feel like we should say is the American Enterprise Institute,
which
is a relatively conservative-leaning think tank, right?
Yep. Totally.
And Philip Kotler is a longtime marketing writer and author and professor, but originally classically trained economist who sort of over the course of about 60 years came around to the idea that capitalism needs confronting and wrote a book by that name, Confronting Capitalism.
But what was really interesting about those two guys is they come from different places, but they wound up essentially at the same place, that something's broken. It's not quite working because there's too much money at the top and not enough for the rest of the 99%. And without getting all loaded phrases here, that's kind of what we're talking about.
We are, and we're talking about the things that today, at least in the show, so we've been examining possible problems. Today in the show, we're going to talk about kind of what happens. And, you know, you've seen everything from Occupy Wall Street to this most recent election cycle and a lot of the unrest that tends to sometimes come up when enough people believe that the system is not working for them. And the question becomes, the somewhat urgent question, in fact, becomes, what do all those distressed human assets do with their frustration? So to answer that question, we got Sherry Berman on the line, and we're doing it live. Sherry is a professor of political science at Barnard College in New York City. Her area of expertise is pretty relevant to this discussion. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
Sherry, what is populism, and why is it something we should be thinking about right now?
I think it's very important to recognize that populism is a symptom, so to speak, of democratic dysfunction and not primarily a cause. That is to say, populism arises at times when existing democratic institutions, governments, political parties, political elites are seen as not responding to the challenges that societies face. That is to say, sort of making sure that people's needs or interests are responded to and society's problems are dealt with.
How does populism tend to appear in Western democratic governments? Like, just sort of historically speaking, is this sort of our form of revolution in some ways?
So that's a great question. I mean, in a place like the United States, where we have primarily a two-party system, populists tend to be insurgents, right? So within the contemporary situation, they tend to become or to be generated by insurgencies within the existing parties. So Donald Trump coming in and kind of taking over the Republican Party, or at least taking and pushing aside the establishment Republican candidates, Bernie Sanders within the Democratic Party. In American history in the past, we've had populist-type movements that have kind of emerged outside the party system and then pressured parties to kind of adopt some of their policies. One might think of Occupy in that vein, the Tea Party in that vein. In the late 19th century, we, of course, had the movement that generated the name populism, that is to say, the populist movement, which emerged to kind of pressure the government to deal with the dislocations that farmers and others left behind by global capitalism were feeling. In European countries, where you have more open electoral systems, proportional representation systems, populists often form their own parties because it's possible to gain seats in parliaments with less than 50% of the vote. So there you often see populism as new parties that sort of come into the system and sort of begin to capture enough votes to get first positions in parliament and then maybe positions in government. But in the United States, it tends to be pressure on the party system or insurgencies within the two main parties that we tend to see populism.
So what do you do then with an economic system that is working for an increasingly small proportion of the population? That economic system is trying to operate in a deeply, deeply fractured political environment. What does that say?
Well, and of course, that political fracturing or that political polarization and the economic developments are directly related. Yeah. The more economically unequal society is, the more polarized, again, people become, and it tends to feed off each other. I mean, it's important to remember, as you pointed out earlier in your segment, that when democracy was rebuilt in the West after 1945, particularly in Western Europe, it was done precisely along the lines that you asked your listeners to talk about, right? Which is capitalism was controlled. The idea was that the state was supposed to confine markets so that they didn't become dislocating. Welfare states were supposed to protect citizens from capitalism's harshest effects. And that was the entire post-war bargain, right? We had a version of that in our New Deal under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which is capitalism would remain, but it would be kind of contained or regulated or limited somewhat. That bargain began to break down in the late 20th century, and we now have a capitalism or markets that are much less constrained, and with that has come rising inequality and increasing polarization. So something needs to be done to kind of set capitalism back on track so that it can continue to generate economic growth and prosperity, which is what it does do best, but it has to do so and distribute the benefits of that growth much more evenly.
And this isn't just a U.S. phenomenon. I mean, although we think of European capitalism as having a stronger welfare state component, we're still seeing these sort of movements and uprisings in Europe.
Absolutely. I mean, so you're absolutely right in the sense that the welfare state part of European capitalism has been much more prominent over the post-war period and remains so. But there have definitely been general trends across the West, including rising inequality. And so what we've seen in Europe, again, is a different, perhaps somewhat different versions of what we've seen in the United States. That is to say, rising populist votes, oftentimes for populist parties on the right, but often populist parties on the left. We saw this recently in the Austrian elections, where a large populist party came in a strong third. We saw it in Germany, where for the first time during the post-war period, we now have a populist right-wing party in the German party. We saw it in the French elections a little while back, where Le Pen lost to Macron in the presidential election, but the National Front got its largest share of the vote ever. So we've seen populist parties really surging forward pretty much all across Europe.
Is it possible for an economic system that's as out of whack as this one is to heal itself, do you think?
Well, it won't heal itself on its own. It will heal itself because politicians and political parties and governments have kind of shoved it back on track. I mean, everybody asked this question after the Great Depression, right? Everybody said, look, capitalism was a failure. It produced this horrific crisis, and there's simply no way that it's ever going to be a system that can provide both prosperity and justice. And this was the appeal of communism after 1945, which we forget, but was very strong in Western Europe after the Second World War, precisely because of the catastrophe of the Great Depression. And what was rebuilt after 1945 in Europe, and then again earlier with the New Deal in the United States, which suffered horribly from the Great Depression, was a capitalism that was, again, much more limited, much more controlled, and combined with many, many more social protection mechanisms. And it was precisely to avoid the catastrophe of the interwar years, which was not simply an economic catastrophe, although it was surely that, but a political one as well, because it helped to undermine democracy in many parts of Europe. And so the idea was that for democracy to work after 1945, capitalism would need to be reconstructed as well. And that's precisely what happened. And that's a much lesser, much milder version of the same challenge that we face today.
Hmm. That would seem to argue that at some point, when you get to the point of populist revolt, that maybe that's not a bad thing, that maybe that's a corrective moment.
I think that's an excellent point, right? I think that's precisely where we are today. Populist parties are not fascist and national socialist parties, but they are extremely critical of the system, and they are potentially very dangerous to it. But they are, in fact, precisely as you say, a warning sign. They are a sign that there are many dissatisfied people out there, and that there are many issues that the existing political establishment has not dealt with successfully. If the establishment responds to these people who feel marginalized, to these demands that have not been addressed, then populism will be, in retrospect, I think, seen as a healthy corrective. If the political establishment chooses to ignore these disaffected and marginalized voters and not deal with these challenges, then we should expect populists, the appeal of populists to grow, and the challenge to liberal capitalist democracy to continue to increase.
Is it possible, do you think, for individuals to take concrete steps that will alleviate this, or does it somehow need to be more systemic?
Well, I think the problems that we have in our society are systemic, but that doesn't mean that individuals can't solve them or at least contribute to their solution. I mean, that's what democracy is all about. It's about people coming together collectively to choose leadership that that deals with society's problems. So, I mean, in addition to obviously becoming involved in one's community, the most important thing citizens can do on a systemic level is to think carefully about who they vote for, about which parties and politicians are offering real solutions to real problems, and perhaps getting involved even beyond voting in the political system itself, because ultimately, given challenges of this extent, this scope, we're really going to need the government to, you know, step in and deal with it. And so figuring out what type of government, that is to say, Democratic or Republican in the United States, is most likely to have good solutions to these problems is really what citizens need to be thinking most about right now.
Perfect. Okay, Sherry, we got one more for you. We ask everybody this question. There is no right answer. There is no wrong answer. It's just whatever your gut tells you. And it goes like this. What is something you thought you knew, but then you discovered you were wrong about?
What is something I thought? How strong political tribalism in the United States actually is. That people have now become so entrenched in their political teams that they are much less open to facts and empirical arguments that I, even as a political scientist, would have liked to have believed.
That's a good one. I like that
one. That's kind of dark.
Yeah.
It's a really good answer. Kind of a bummer.
I should have ended with something more positive.
No, it's good. Reality is reality, right?
I mean, outstanding. Sherry Berman is a professor of political science at Barnard College in New York City. Sherry, thank you so much. That was fascinating.
Thank you very much.
So.
All right. That was a lot to think about.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yep. Digest it. Listen to it 5 times. Rewind a bunch. And then tell us what you think. I have many thoughts. Write to us, though. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. You can go to our website at MakeMeSmart.org and leave a comment. Or you can tweet us at Kai Rizdahl and at Molly Wood.
Next up, we will chat briefly, I think, about what we just heard from Sherry and talk about the book club. But first, a little music.
Oh, the farmer is the man. The farmer is the man. Lives on credit till the fall. Then they take him by the hand and they lead him from the land, and the middleman's the one who gets it all. Oh, the farmer is the man.
So here is the deal with that song. It's called The Farmer is the Man, in case you couldn't tell. Actually, a populist protest song from late 1800s. Farmers were being affected by low inflation and thus low prices for their crops. Pete Seeger, right there, the late great Pete Seeger, singing a version of it.
Yeah, and you heard Sherry actually mention the populist party that did come out of the farmers' alliances and that kind of all of the agricultural distress of the 1880s. I went down a tiny little rabbit hole reading about the populist movement and how they had a presidential candidate named James Weaver. And you too can find all of this on the internet. I think you will. I think you will enjoy it. I have to say, I could have talked to Sherry all day long because I think that the historical perspective on this and how this is sort of always what happens in times of income inequality all the way back to, you know, Rome never gets old for me.
Nope. And I think her last bit there, I don't know how the edit on that thing's going to go, but I think the last bit about we'll see if the populist movement in this country solves the people's problems is the really, it's the payoff pitch right there.
Well, because
my baseball metaphors.
Yeah, no, because that's what it. We either adhere to the warning or things get really way worse, actually.
Yep.
So, hey, hope springs eternal. All right, let's see. What else is going on? If you missed the last episode, was it the last episode in which we announced our book club choice?
I believe so.
It is A Wrinkle in Time. So go out and get it if you haven't, because that's coming up. We're only giving ourselves about a month, well, now 3 weeks to read that one, because we want to get our book club done. It's an easy one. You can read it with the kids. You can get the graphic novel.
It's
actually a very handy time to be reading this, because as a result of the upcoming movie, the book is available everywhere. Like, I was just at Barnes & Noble yesterday. Yes, a real store. A real brick-and-mortar bookstore. And it was all over the place. There were just these huge displays of A Wrinkle in Time. And I was like, oh, they totally listened to our show, clearly.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ava DuVernay. She's a listener, I'm sure. It is not an understatement to say that your questions have helped drive this entire question of free market capitalism and whether fundamentally we're doing it right. So we're going to get a couple more of them in here right now.
Make me smart.
Make me smart.
Hey, make me smart.
All right, here it is. Randall Lukasiewicz has a two-part question about the idea, the very idea of moral capitalism.
How does the protest economy, which you discuss in one of your earliest podcasts, fit into moral capitalism as a whole? And secondly, is there anything that we can do as individuals to bring about a form of capitalism that works for everyone?
We should just put him back on the phone with Sherry.
I mean, she pretty much did say no, right? It's a systemic problem with a systemic solution that's going to have to happen.
Well, she said there are certainly things. I mean, you can run for office. You get there's no question that you can be part of the solution. And I think that's a little bit in there. We're going to, though, I will say, for a longer discussion about that, are going to pass that along to you. But I think the protest economy, to the first part of Randall's question, the protest economy is absolutely part of the kind of the klaxon, the warning that is being sounded.
Good word,
klaxon. I don't know where that came from.
A good word.
I was reading some stuff in.
Ooga, dive. That's a klaxon,
yeah,
right?
Totally. It's a klaxon. I was reading some stuff in French earlier, and then that's what happened.
Oh, man, humble brag.
I know. I wish I
was reading
that
some stuff in ancient Greek.
I was reading some stuff in ancient Greek.
Look.
Like I
anyway,
do.
Do us a favor and send us your thoughts on this whole thing, because y'all have them. That's part of what's driving this whole thing.
We're going to pass this to
you. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org and you know, send us your thoughts. Send us voice memos. Those are always good. And we can play them on the pod.
Yeah. And send us if you think that there are solutions. We've been really, you know, you hear us really pushing all of our guests, like, what can be done? And so send us any ideas that you have to help, because why not, right? If any old commenter on the internet could have the solution to this, so that could be you. Email us or send us a voice memo.
Which is not to say that you're any old commenter on the internet.
Well, no, but that's listener. What I'm, you know, it's a, this is the
yep.
the democratic platform that is the podcasting and the interweb and the whatnot. All right, yes. More from you next in just a moment.
The copper bosses killed you, Joe. Whoa. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die.
How about that last note right there? That was Paul Robeson. I knew that was Paul Robeson even before I read my notes. A song called Joe Hill, written in the 30s as part of the labor movement in this country.
Yeah, producer Jenny was on fire this week with the protest song transitions. But as you can hear, these swings toward populism that happen as a response to economic imbalance turn into, very often, great music. I mean, the 60s were, and it's funny, I read an article not that long ago sort of posing the question of, like, where's all the protest music? And what's happening in our music environment. That should be a show. We should do a whole episode. But last year, when Prince died, Kai interviewed Yale University professor Daphne Brooks. I'm still so upset about that. And it turns out that she is currently teaching a class at Yale called We the People, Protest Music in America and the Black Freedom Struggle. We tried to get her on the show, but she is sort of in the middle of grading papers right now. She did, however, send us the syllabus for the class, which is essentially the greatest Spotify playlist ever. And since Jenny is on fire and you're always asking for the music that we play on the show, we made you a Spotify playlist. And you can find it at makemesmart.org. I know. Talk about this is like a days. This is an omni-channel situation.
We are a full service podcast. Right.
We are transmedia.
All y'all still have a whole lot of thoughts about capitalism.
Yeah, these are thoughts, or as I like to call them, future episodes. Here we go.
Where do we mail a letter?
On the subject of your program on distressed human assets and fair market capitalism, as Congress goes about negotiating out the proposed tax plan, one has to wonder about the extent to which Congress people are really negotiating for their own interests, either as capitalists themselves or as folks who just want to do whatever it will take to get reelected. Too cynical?
All right, that was Nadine Thorne. Here's our next listener.
I was listening to your episode on how to improve capitalism, and I literally shouted bullshit at my car radio when your guest, Dr. Brooks, argued against Molly's assertion that the owners of capital are not motivated to be fair. I'm not an economist, but it seems to me that the history and present of the labor movement serves to comprehensively disprove his assertion. Throughout history, workers attempting to organize themselves have been met with, at best, tacit disapproval, and at worst, active violence by management and ownership. Just this month, the owner of Gothamist and DNA Info, Joe Ricketts, tied for number 386 on Forbes 400 2017, shut down both websites after the sites voted to unionize. This is just one recent example, but with 10 minutes with Google, I could find 100 more, from warehouse workers to academia. It strikes me that the arguments for unfettered capitalism always ignore one fundamental tenet of the human existence: greed. Without external checks on this tendency towards avarice, either as regulation or organized labor or both, we are never going to reach a point where we can say that capitalism is truly fair, or ethical, or moral, or enlightened, or whatever we end up settling on. Thanks for the great podcast. I love it and listen to it every week, even if your guests occasionally make me yell at my dashboard.
The free market doesn't care whether you live or die. That's just a fact.
I think that was Andrew Meisner, by the way. And I think that we're doing our jobs if you are yelling back at the car dashboard.
I think
to everything that he said. I mean, and Philip Kotler, actually, one of the things that he specifically pointed to as a moment when, or a reason that capitalism had lost its way, was the decline of the power of the unions and the sort of the lack of power that the workers have. And I think I was listening to something. I was listening to Forum on KQED this morning, and they were talking about the tax policy that is being discussed right now, and how it is a tax policy that might make sense if we were in a situation where we had really high interest rates and businesses didn't have a lot of access to capital and they weren't doing very well and making lots of money. And that is not the case.
Well, it's true. So what's really interesting actually is this whole
this
whole tax policy conversation we're having right now does not match the economic moment. That is absolutely true. And yet the people in power, which is to say the owners of capital, seem to be okay with that.
Right. Well, and the people who are the owners of capital at this moment are not, even though they are swimming in capital, the stock market is booming, interest rates are in their favor, and they have plenty of access to capital, they're not spreading it around and paying people more. And so the argument that by giving them more money, they will then spread it around and pay people more would seem to maybe not hold water when we are in such a moment of, let's say, hoarding.
Don't hoard your reviews and opinions about us. Go to Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review. Tell us what you think. Subscribe and get your friends to subscribe.
I just got like a terrible headache in my eyeball. I don't know where that came from.
And I will come up with another good segue next week.
The pain. See you then.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know.
You had a long day already, bud.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and the senior producer, Nancy Vargalli. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music is composed by Ben Talladay, was composed, I guess, by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves, who heartily disapproves of transitions such as the one that Kai Rizdahl just made. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark, from whom Kai can expect a stern note shortly.
Well, she is. One of those two women are the ones who told me to update my LinkedIn profile. So I'm just saying.
Oh, really good point.
We'll see you next week. Maybe I won't. Molly might be doing it all alone. I don't know. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I don't know.
Anything could happen.
Don't mind me. I'm just the talent.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.